Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You're listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with Scott and Maria. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingüe. And this is a pre-recorded show, so... But for other shows, our phone number here at the station is 337-8874. And you can also access this show, if you missed it, through our podcast at kxorradio.com.
Hi, good morning. How are you today?
Good.
Good. Welcome. We have an interesting show today. We have a filmmaker aboard. He is the producer and director of a documentary film called Abused, The Postville Raid. And I wish I could do the capital U.S. in the middle of abused somehow by saying it, but you can't. His name is Luis Argueta, and he, again, is the director and producer of Abused, The Postville Raid. And today we're going to talk about immigration and some of the stress that comes with immigration and maybe some of the trauma that comes with immigration. Good morning, Luis. How are you?
Good morning, Scott. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning.
Good morning, Radio Bilingüe. Thank you for the opportunity to be in your program.
Oh, welcome aboard. First of all, what does it take to make a film? You just don't
money.
Get up in the morning and say...
That's right, money. Money and madness. It is totally insane to make a film.
What was the process like for you, and what led you in this direction, and how did this come about?
When I first heard about the Postville Raid, I have to be totally honest, I didn't pay much attention to it because I was too busy with my life. It was the day after the raid. It was the morning of May the 13th.
Luis, sorry to interrupt you. This is Maria. What is the Postville Raid? Postville Raid.
The Postville Raid is the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency's largest, most expensive and most brutal and definitely most controversial immigration raid in the history of the United States. It took place in a small town in northeastern Iowa by the name of Postville, P-O-S-T. Some people think it's Postville, but no, it is Post. A man by the last name of Post founded that little town. This town has 2,000 inhabitants, has no traffic lights, not a single fast food restaurant, and it is what I describe as a little town in the prairie. And unlike many other places like this, it presented a diversity that you usually find only in large metropolitan areas. You had a group of nationalities and ethnic groups living together and working at the largest kosher meatpacking plant and slaughterhouse in the country as well. So in the morning of May the 12th, about 900 federal agents with the support of helicopters and buses and federal and state troopers descended on to Postville, surrounded the plant, and arrested 389 undocumented workers, mainly from Guatemala, but there were several from Mexico, a couple from Ukraine, and they herded them in chains to a place an hour and a half away called the National Cattle Congress, where farmers usually show their cattle. And there, in a matter of 4 days, obtained guilty pleas from most of them using an offer that people couldn't refuse. Many of these people, almost 200, were sent to jail for 5 months and then deported.
And how many people lived in Postville?
The population used to be 2,200.
Wow. And 900 federal agents.
So,
wow.
Yeah, so it was an a military style operation that not only resulted in the arrest of these people, but also totally traumatized the town. Just imagine that you are a 12-year-old and you're in school and you're in the eighth grade, and all of a sudden you hear helicopters and you go out the window and you realize that La Migra is come to town and that they are flying over the factory where your mother and father are working. So not only they arrested 389 workers, but a lot of the people who worked the night shift who were not working fled the town afraid that they would come back and do house-to-house searches. So in a few hours, Paulsville was reduced to, you know, lost about 40% of its population.
And you saw this on, you heard about it on the news.
I heard about it on the radio. I'm a person that loves to wake up to radio.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I was too busy with my life, made a little note on about a story that I was working on about maybe changing one of the workers from a field hand in California to a meat packer in Iowa. And then went about my life, finished what I was doing, and 2 months later, on July 11th, I read an article on the front page of the New York Times by Julia Preston, the immigration correspondent for the New York Times. And she talked about an interpreter who had been hired by the federal government to work the trials that followed the raid. He and 12 other interpreters, federal interpreters, were summoned to the National Cattle Congress in Waterloo, being told that they were going to be working on a continuity of operations exercise. That was the extent of what they were told. This interpreter, originally from Cuba, who was also a professor in Miami, went to do his job, and he couldn't believe and he couldn't keep inside what he saw, what he heard, and wrote a 14-page essay, which there was a link to this essay in the article in the New York Times. So I read the article and I read the essay, and I can say that that moment my life changed, because I decided to go to Iowa to see for myself what I was reading, and I really couldn't believe it was true.
What was it that you read that changed?
I read how this military operation, military-style operation, had been carried out, and how women had been separated from their husbands, kids had been separated from their parents, and how the population was so afraid of going home that by 6 p.m. that day, the Catholic Church in town had about 400 people that had come to seek refuge there and refused to leave and stayed for at least a week. I read about how lawyers had been assigned 17 defendants per lawyer, how they had been summarily tried, and how many of them could hardly understand Spanish because their native language was a Maya language, and how they had been offered, as I said before, a plea deal that they couldn't refuse because it was either you pled guilty to using fake papers, or you would be charged with aggravated identity theft, which as of 9/11 of 2001 carries a minimum of 2 years in jail if you're found guilty. And it can have a penalty of up to $250,000. So these people who were totally traumatized by the way they had been arrested were now in very cold settings without shoes, says one of the workers that was arrested, with only a T-shirt, and they were kept up, kept awake throughout the night, being questioned one, two, and three times, and always in an open setting. There was no privacy between the defense attorney and the defendant, and they understood that it was either go to jail 5 months or risk maybe two or more years in jail, and that is at a trial that you didn't know when it would take place. So the whole legal way this was done was one of the factors that most impressed me.
Why weren't they just deported? Or is this the custom usually of holding them for 5 months and then for 2 years or whatever they plead, and then then get deported?
No, there's many theories, and one of the ones that I believe was true, that Paulsville was really to be a test case as well as a way to set an example. In the past, people would be detained for, you know, for committing some kind of crime, and they would be found to be in the country without proper documentation, and soon after that would be deported. In this case, they had very carefully orchestrated the plea deal. Indeed, there was another factor that was told by the interpreter in his essay, and which later I corroborated with some of the defense attorneys, and that was that there had been a meeting of the prosecutors, the leading judge, and the defense attorneys on the morning of the 12th of May. At this meeting, every attorney was handed a 117-page three-ring binder, which outlined all the possible outcomes of the trials. The ACLU obtained a copy of that three-ring binder. We also did later, but it came to light early in the story. And there was one attorney that refused to go along with this because he thought that it was unconscionable for him as an attorney to defend more than one person at a time, given that in a criminal case, the first thing you do when you have a person that you're defending is try to find if he or she knows something about somebody else. And if he was defending 17 at the time, it was just a big conflict of interest. So it was trying to set an example. And interestingly enough, maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago, it came to light that the Corrections Corporation of America, which is a corporation that constructs detention centers, was very involved in the drafting of the famous Arizona law. If you heard the story in NPR, which was a two-part story,
that's our competition. We don't listen to them.
Well, but it came out to light that there was a for-profit corrections corporation drafting a law that would reduce clients for their jails. So
they'd be able to basically write legislation that would improve their business, but there's kind of a human expense to that.
Exactly. Not only, a human expense, and paid by all tax taxpayers.
So when you did this movie, when in the, you know, at that point when you saw this lawyer's testimony in the New York Times, saw his essay, you must have had to make several trips out. I mean, it really, you must have had to immerse yourself basically in the lives of these immigrants in their town, in order to get the story.
Initially, Scott, I was not thinking that I would spend a lot of time in this project. I just wanted to see what I had read, talk to some people, maybe 3-4 little what I call portraits of immigrants, which was something I had started doing. And these portraits of immigrants were 4 or 5 minute long little movies that I put online as a part of a series called Voices of Silence. And it chronicled the life of people who had just arrived, had just been told that they were going to be deported, and who were at different stages of immigration process. However, after 4 days being there and on my way to the airport, I told my partner that I felt I couldn't go back to New York. I dropped her off at the airport, turned around, went back to Postville and stayed a week, and then continued going back. And in total, I went back 29 times.
One of the things is when I'm hearing this is, you know, they were illegally here in the United States.
Yes.
And they have no rights. They have no rights. I'm looking at it as a U.S. citizen here in the United States. I, too, when I cross the border, and I constantly cross the border back and forth between Mexico and the United States because I have family there. And once I go into that port of entry, I have no rights either. My rights, I see myself as I have no rights. Even though I'm a U.S. citizen, I have no rights whatsoever. You know, they ask you questions, they probe you. Luckily, I don't do that because I have the sentry cards, but, you know, it's... And then, you know, this film is about people that were here illegally, and they have no rights. I have no rights sometimes, even as a U.S. citizen here in the United States, you know, when I go into the port of entry. I mean, when I'm trying to go to Disneyland, you know, there's a border inspection, and they ask you questions. If I want to go to San Diego, they stop me and ask me questions. You know, at those points, there's no rights for me. You know, they can at any time say, you know what, get to the side of the road and I have to go through your car and all that. So, and I feel bad for the immigrants because they had families and family, but I think, you know, it's, I mean, I'm all for immigration, but, you know, they were also illegally here.
Well, yeah, there's a couple parts to your statement. I totally disagree that they were here and had no rights because they have no immigration status. And I also disagree to the fact that when you go into the border, you have no rights. We have surrendered a lot of our rights, and that is something that we voluntarily have to do. You know, the Constitution guarantees that we will not be searched without proper cause, and that we will not be arrested without justification.
Sometimes that doesn't feel right when I'm at the port of entry.
Well, yeah, of course. And today, I think that we live in fear, and we have allowed a lot of our rights to be hijacked by fear.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that that's something that we should be thinking about. But these people, they were here without proper immigration documentation, and that is a fact. However, as workers, they have rights. As human beings, they have rights. As they say, you know, we realize that this was not right, that we should pay for what we did, which was working with fake papers, but the way that they were treated is not the way that the Constitution and the human rights of the world dictate that people be treated. That's for one thing. I think that to try to set an example by arresting totally vulnerable people with a show of force like what happened there is absolutely ridiculous and unconscionable. And we as citizens of this country should not allow that to ever happen again. I also think that we should take a very good look at these laws that are not working. I mean, there were many things that have been legal in this country and many other countries, which today are not. Slavery is not legal, and it definitely was never right. So we have 11.1 million people without proper documentation in this country, and I tell you, most of these people are here because this is their last chance. They're not here because they want to be here specially, and they also are here because we are complicit in making them be here. We hire them when we eat the food from the supermarkets. We are making it possible for them to be here when we let them make our beds in the hotels. And, you know, we are here, you know, we're helping keeping them here when we let them mow our lawns and clean our houses and clean our hotels and wash our cars. So there's a lot of hypocrisy on our part.
I know in rural California, as we're in rural California, that there's always been kind of a reliance on undocumented workers to do the work, quote unquote, that no one else would do. Meatpacking pretty much falls into that same category, huh?
Yeah.
Did the business out there, did they actually kind of recruit, or how did people know to go to northern Iowa to find work?
You know, immigration is an extremely elastic phenomenon. Today, with access to cell phones, I will call my cousin in a little village in Mexico or El Salvador and tell him, get your butt over here because they're hiring. Mm-hmm. Or I will call him and say, don't even think about coming because there are no jobs. So it responds to the market conditions. People also go to areas where they have relatives and friends. And there's not any evidence that the employer in Postville recruited, but there have been channels established between communities of origin and the town of Postville, so that you found many, many people from the same towns living there. It wasn't like you had people from 20 different villages in Guatemala living in Postville. You found people coming from the same region and maybe four or five little villages in the same area, because, you know, they came to where their friends and family were.
And that's what you said, friends and family. Were there also, what about, did any of the people that were here illegally have children that were born here in the United States? What happened? And if so, what happened to them?
Well, there were in the region from where a lot of the workers came in Guatemala, I have identified 14 U.S. citizen children, which I call de facto deportees. These were kids born in the U.S. who, once their parents were deported or decided to go back because they had no way of changing their immigration status, have become deportees themselves and are living now in rural areas without access to health care, proper nutrition, or education. So that, unfortunately, is the truth.
And I'm asking that because right now they're pushing for an immigration law that makes it that people who are here illegally and have children here does not make them automatically U.S. citizens. And, you know, they're pushing for that. And you know, I'm probably a good example is that, you know, my daughter was not born here in the United States, but she is a U.S. citizen because I am a U.S. citizen. And her dad is a U.S. citizen.
Uh-huh.
And that's where they're trying to go, it's your citizenship is based on your parents' citizenship.
Well, to change birthright citizenship, we would need a constitutional amendment, so that wouldn't be such an easy thing to do. I think...
And they're pushing it because it's Arizona, our next door neighbor from us, that is pushing for that immigration law.
Yeah, and I think that unfortunately is another very myopic way of looking at things, because what that would do is create an addition to the undocumented population. If kids all of a sudden were born here and had no citizenship, they would be undocumented. And that would not make them go away immediately, mm-hmm. as we would like. You know, there's a lot of myths surrounding U.S. citizen children of undocumented immigrants. One of them is that they come here to have kids so that they will anchor them and help them become citizens. And that is totally unproved. The large majority of women who have children here have been in the U.S. for several years, 5 years usually. For a U.S. citizen child to petition his parents, he has to wait until he or she is 21. So it is a very roundabout and long way to try to become a citizen.
Here in the border, it's a little bit different, because it's a way of life here, is that there's so many people, my family and friends that came across the border, they're from Mexico and came across the border to have their kids here. I mean, that's everybody loans everybody's addresses and you know, there's a lot of them did come over here to have their kids, and they actually paid, you know, the medical, because the family was well off in Mexico and wanted to have their children born here in the United States, and they paid for it.
Uh-huh.
But there's many more that, you know, ended up on Medi-Cal paid for it, or government assistance paid for the children to be born here, and they had no intention of living here, and then they went back to Mexico. And, you know, but they wanted their children to have U.S. citizenship.
Just to keep their options open?
Yeah,
is that how it works?
Yeah, just have to keep their options open, and they live, and they go to school, and they everything in Mexico, but, you know, they still have their U.S. citizenship, and eventually in the future, if they do want to come and work here, they have their U.S. citizenship.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that there's a lot of people who stretch the law, and I wouldn't put it past anybody, but I think that in general that is not the case, and I think that you said, you know, they want their kids to have a better education, they want to be here, so that's probably the case, and I think
it's a natural thing. Everybody wants the best for their kids.
Yeah, and we as a country with an aging population, we need young kids. We need well-educated, well-trained young people that will pay for our retirement, because the demographics is such that we are an aging country. And if we want to preserve our status in the industrialized world, we need young people, and we need to train and educate them well. So
I'm only having one. I only have one daughter. That's it. No more.
The Chinese would be happy with you. Well, no, because it's a daughter. Oh,
yes.
My God.
Yes, it's a daughter.
So on those 29 visits to Postville, and you had to go to Guatemala a few times too, correct?
Yes. After I had been to Postville a few times, I was there during a time when a group of five families had decided to ask for voluntary departure, given that their attorney recommended that they do that instead of trying to stay and apply for some kind of U visa or other type of visa that would help them regulate their status. So they apply for this voluntary departure and were to leave in August of 2008. I went with them and accompanied them also to their village of origin, and because they had to report to the U.S. Embassy and they had returned, I saw them a couple times and then met their relatives, and I then realized that the people who were in jail for 5 months were going to be going back in October. So I began working to be ready to follow those that were returning. And then it became more than just making a film. It became a journey with people who were becoming more and more like my family. And when I started this, I didn't know much about immigration. And so it was also a journey in which I was learning a lot about this incredible phenomena, which is global and which I think is one of the crucial issues of our times.
There's no way to be a part of this without becoming very intimate to it.
Yeah. And, you know, I consider myself an immigrant. I was lucky that I came with all the proper documentation. I became a naturalized citizen after being at a university here, and I've made a conscious choice of making the U.S. my country, and I'm very happy about that, and I would like others to have that opportunity. And as the saying goes, you know, therefore the grace of God go I. I mean, I consider this pure chance that I came with papers and somebody else comes without papers. Or they come with papers and overstay their visa, which is the case with many, many people.
Well, what we'll do then is we're going to take a short top of the hour break. And when we come back, we'll start to talk about the intensity of being an immigrant, about what that does to mental health, and about how that impacts people. And you can share some of your experiences from getting to know them. And we'll kind of bring it back down here so that we can kind of reflect on what it means to be an immigrant in our community and how that might play out in terms of mental health. So let's talk about it, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Let's Talk About It, presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services, each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM Radio Bilingue.
Welcome back. You're still listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with Scott and Maria. And our phone number here at the station is area code 760-337-8874. And we are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7.
Yeah, that's us. Hi, good morning. We're welcoming.
Hello.
Hey, good. Hi. We're here today with Luis Argueta, and he is director, producer, filmmaker, Guatemalan national icon. No, can we claim that on the radio? Is that fair?
Sure.
All right. And your latest film is Abused, the Postville Raid, and we've kind of spent the first half of the hour really talking about how you got to know the people of Postville really, really, really intimately. I mean, it's been an incredible journey for you. And now, if we could, you know, we're a nation of immigrants at some level.
Sure.
I was here long before you.
And some of us are you know, multi-generation immigrants, and others of us are more closer to the source, I suppose. But go back far enough, and there wasn't actually anybody in North America.
Exactly. That's true.
But so in getting to know these immigrants, let's kind of talk about their lives a little bit, and let's see if there's some reflective points that we can take and share with our own community and what people go through in their own immigrant stories, you know, here in the Imperial Valley. When in getting to know these immigrants, Luis, getting here, in and of itself, must be an ordeal. What was that like for them?
You know, when I heard the stories of people getting here, of the amount of money they had to borrow, which was around anything from $4,000 to $6,000, $7,000, at 10%, 15%, and sometimes 20% a month, and what women had to endure. A lot of women begin to take birth control pills before they embark on this journey because the chances that they will be raped are 100%. The going through the desert, and I've been to the desert in Arizona, it is grueling. To think that you know, people walk for weeks and months, to me, is just totally incredible. So I remember asking a woman very early on, said, why did you put up with all of that? And why did you come here and work under such grueling circumstances? Because they were working 14 hours a day in extremely harsh conditions, where their breaks were minimal, if they had any, where often they had to wear diapers or they would have to urinate standing up in the line. And I said, why do you put up with this? And she said, from nothing to a little bit, there's a big difference.
Mm.
And when you think that the choice is either starving or watching your kids starving or your aging parents not be able to get their medicine, the choice becomes no choice at all. So that's why they came. I was specially impacted by one boy whose mother had been working at the time of the raid, and he was 11 at the time, and he and his sister were in school, and they both knew that she was going to be arrested. What they didn't know is that the mother, afraid of what she had heard, which was that they would bring the kids and take them to jail with them, denied having kids. And therefore, she was sent to the National Cal Congress, was tried and condemned to 5 months in jail. Other women who, like her, had children underage at home, when asked, said yes, and were sent home with an ankle monitoring device, which kept track of them 24 hours a day, and which was, you know, no walk in the park, but it was better than being in jail. So this woman was in jail, and her son, who was 11, and her daughter, who was 5, all of a sudden were home in the care of their father. And the father would not let him out of the basement except for meals. And for a week, they lived in the basement. And
waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah. Can you imagine the kind of trauma that those kids experienced? And there was another family where the father of two little girls was sent to jail for 5 months. And it's now almost 3 years since he last saw his kids. His wife was sent home with an ankle bracelet, and these women were supposed to go home and take care of their kids, but since the ankle bracelet meant they couldn't work, they had to rely on public charity. And since they couldn't travel beyond a certain perimeter, it meant that they couldn't go anywhere. They had to wait until they were called to go before a judge. So those were some of the most poignant stories that I came across.
So in some respects, though, it sounds like people who are immigrants who do this process, as you mentioned, kind of do it out of extreme need. But the other thing is the process of getting here is almost like like their own personal war. I mean, mm-hmm. we look at like a war situation and see that the trauma, you know, to the soldiers and to the civilians who are in, around a war zone. But the process of getting here and the possible abuses that people endure and the hardships that they endure is akin to that kind of experience, only, again, kind of highly individualized because it's really that person who's experiencing instead of, say, an identified group of people as a war would be. Is that fair?
I think it is fair. And it's, now that you mentioned war, a lot of these people who came from Guatemala, they're too young to have lived the 36-year war between 1960 and 1996. But some of them were children during the 80s, and some of them have secondary memories from their parents and their grandparents about the war. And one of the things that people remember is the helicopters and how the helicopters were the first sign that death was coming.
Yeah,
to their village. So on the day of the raid, some of the women said that's what they thought, that's what they flashed to, the stories or their memories of the war. But you know, it was not just the children of immigrants and the parents of immigrants who suffered trauma. These kids went to school and went to daycare with all the other kids in the town, mm-hmm. with all the other U.S. citizen kids, with all the blonde, blue-eyed kids from Iowa. And those blonde, blue-eyed kids experienced trauma because all of a sudden their best friend was gone. And they would ask their parents, you know, are they going to come and take you away also? And these kids also experienced some signs like wetting their clothes at night and during the day, and a lot of them began to refuse to go to school. So it was a generic traumatizing experience.
Well, and I think we tell ourselves that stuff like that can't happen here, and so, you know, for people like Marie and I, whose, you know, documentation status is fairly easy to prove.
Yours is. I don't know.
You know, I don't know that day to day we experience the same stress that somebody whose immigration status is less secure would be experiencing.
No, but you know what? I grew up in Calexico, which is, my house is only about two blocks away from the Mexican border. You know, even me walking and at night or coming home late from school, you know, Border Patrol would stop and ask me, you know, are you here legally? Are you a U.S. citizen? And, you know, I had to be ready to say, yes, I'm a U.S. citizen. And where do you live? I live over there. And, you know, I don't know if they still do that, but I remember back in the 70s and 80s walking home from school, you had to be alert and know that there's a Border Patrol right close by. And they would ask me, you know, just, and it was awful. I hated to be, you know, asked that.
Well, imagine if you come from a country where the authorities, when they stop you, they'll either ask for a bribe or they could rob you or they could, you know, be violent to you or they, you know, the stories of Guatemala and Mexico are unfortunately very horrible. And in the past, if you were considered a rebel or somebody who didn't agree with the status quo, you would be labeled a subversive, and being a subversive meant that you would probably disappear. So there's a lot of memories, again, either proper own memories or memories from the parents that really all of a sudden are revived when you begin to live in what we can consider a police state, you know? And that's very unfortunate because that's just not a situation of the individual, but I think it carries to the group.
So in addition to this kind of experience of immigration, which has its own trauma and own difficulties associated with it, people who are living here not only walk around with this kind of constant awareness, perhaps even constant fear, but they're also passing this on to their children and in their communities. It's kind of something that catches around and moves.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately that is the situation. And those are some of the maybe less tangible results of having a system that is not working.
What's your sense after this post-Ville? I mean, I watched the documentary and I saw that there looked like there was the beginnings of a little accountability in terms of Senate hearings and stuff like that at the tail end of this. I mean, we've always kind of told ourselves, I guess, in our community that something like that can't happen here because the agriculture was needed, because, you know, it's growing season up in Central Valley, California, and coincidentally, the Border Patrol checkpoints are down on Highway 8. You know, we always kind of told ourselves that, you know, there's kind of this complicit need for seasonal work, and because of that, we're never going to see kind of these massive, you know, black op kind of raids. What's your sense now, having been through this post-Ville thing? Is that something that is true or not?
I think that, you know, the large work site enforcement raids that had their culmination in post-Ville and a few months later in Laurel, Mississippi, hopefully will not come back. But we have to be very conscious that we cannot allow them to come back. There are calls in Congress and in some corridors of Congress to bring back this kind of enforcement. And not only is it totally destructive, but it's absolutely a waste of money. However, unfortunately, the policy, the immigration policy that we have now, it's really an enforcement-only policy. We have increased number of people at the border. We have increased number of dollars being thrown at the border. We have paper raids. We have E-Verify. That is questionable how good it works. And the effects of this are similar. We deport 1,079 people a day. 1,079 people a day. That's the equivalent of 3 postals a day. Because if somebody gets deported and his family or family stay behind, that doesn't matter if they came with guns or without guns. But the effects are the same.
And do you have any figures on how many of those come back?
No, I don't. But it's interesting. Last week I was at a conference, an immigration conference, and I said, you know, in spite of all this money that we're throwing at enforcement, the numbers of undocumented people in the country have not gone down. And the answer that I got was, well, yes, but the increases haven't gone up either.
Mm. So kind of contrary to what? Point. Kind of contrary, like the war on drugs.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, we are not dealing with the source. I mean, you know, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. You know, I agree that we must have enforcement of the law. I agree that we must try to have a safe country and a safe border, but the insanity of the amount of money that we're spending in what I think is the wrong way, it's totally flabbergasting.
Well, let's pretend for a second that we could actually spend money on lots and lots and lots of money, printed up money, on mental health. It sounds like, just from your experience, that finding out someone's immigration story, even if it's not first generation directly their story, might be an important element of assessment, just to begin to get a sense of how they came to this country and what sort of stuff they might have gone through.
you know, I totally agree, Scott. I came back from a week of showings in Iowa, and I'm continuing with showings around the country at universities, high school, workers' centers, faith-based communities. And what I heard in Postville was, thank you for telling our story. Now we know that the world will understand what happened here. Now we understand what happened after they took the workers away. I really think that just the knowledge and the contextualizing of these events is an important step towards some kind of healing.
How are the people now, the citizens of Postville? It was in a meatpacking place. Are there any more workers? Are there still more illegal immigrant workers? Or what's the status of that town now?
The plant went bankrupt and closed briefly. Then it was sold and is now operating under a new name as a new company and under a new owner. Several of the managers and foremen are the same. And several, if not many, of the workers on the line are the former undocumented workers who now are legal, because the 42 people, 33 women and 11 underage workers who were at the plant the day of the raid or have been at the plant before the raid, U visa, which is a special visa for undocumented workers who are victims of violent abuse. So, many of the people, once they obtained their visa and their work permit, stayed in Postville or went back to Postville because it was what they knew. The mother of the two girls that I mentioned, whose fathers still abroad, walks the kids to daycare and to school, and she can walk to the food pantry, and now she walks to her job. She doesn't drive and doesn't have money to buy a car anyway, so she feels very much at home. And, you know, Postville is a beautiful little town with, you know, tree-lined streets, wide sidewalks, nobody locks their doors, and they have nice lawns. So it's a perfect place to bring up kids. And so I understand why they're still there. They're been bringing people from many parts of the world who are legal, but this means that they're bringing people from even Pacific Islands in small groups. So that is increasing the pressure on the services of Postville and other towns in Iowa and in the Midwest, because instead of having a large Hispanic-speaking population, you have now several little populations that speak different languages. They still haven't managed to get the factory back to 100% capacity, which I think speaks to the difficulty of finding and retaining good workers.
For low-paying jobs. Low-paying jobs.
And long
very
hours.
Hard. Very hard, yeah. And even though the wages increased when the new ownership came into place to about $11, even $12 an hour from $6, $7 that it was just the norm before, but now they've gone down to $8 and $9. So there's a lot of people who are not 100% happy. The union is trying to negotiate a contract with the factory, but nothing is final yet.
Is there a way in a community to mitigate the fear, to be good neighbors, the legal system and public policy? Clearly, those are things that can be worked out at that level. But person to person and community to community, Do you see ways in which we can coexist and work towards the, at least understanding and helping each other to get through the day?
Well, you know, I think that one of the very positive results of the Pulseville raid was that the community, both the immediate community of the town and of the surrounding counties of the state and of the country, really came to support the victims of the raid. And you have people who, I think, for the first time saw immigrants as human beings. And that is also part of the what I hope to achieve with the film, which is bring the human face of immigration and have people direct contact with individuals and with their stories. But I think Pulseville is a great example of what a diverse community can do to survive and thrive together. Pulseville is not back to where it was before, but some of the businesses that closed have reopened or new businesses have opened in those places. It was extremely traumatic economically as well as psychologically. Some estimates say that the economic impact was $300 million because, and that was not just for the town, but for the surrounding areas. There were a lot of people who you know, provided cattle for the plant, who provided feed for the cattle, and a lot of those services were shut down. The restaurants, the clothing stores, everybody lost customers and had to cut down operations or shut down.
Yeah, I think that's always been part of our belief system that the catastrophic economic nature of really closing the border and really making sure that nobody was here without proper documentation would prevent it from ever happening on a super large scale, that it would always kind of be one of those gray areas where people, you know, certainly isn't openly encouraged, but probably not openly discouraged either. But it looks like some of that's changing. If people want to learn more about abuse to the Pulseville raid, where do they go and what do they do?
Please visit us on our website, www.abused.pulseville raid, all one word. Abused the Pulseville Raid blog. And we also have a blog where you can follow our presentations, and that is Abuse the Pulseville Raid blogspot.com.
Thank you so much for coming aboard today.
Thank you so much, Luis.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Maria. Have a great day. And
keep on doing good films, good documentaries.
Thank you. Okay, be well. Keep on doing good radio.
All right, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And thank you again for listening today. This is Let's Talk About It, your voice for wellness here in the Imperial Valley. Join us again next Thursday morning. We'll have another great show for you.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.